From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for John Horn. On today's show, how Harvey Weinstein might settle scores of sexual misconduct lawsuits for $25 million without actually paying a dime himself. Then Matthew Bourne's production of Swan Lake famously casts male dancers as swans.
It's more a psychological battle between a good voice and a bad voice in the white swan and the black swan. That's the way it became once we changed the sex, because it was easier to reflect that.
And then one of the most important and creative periods of Prince's career is celebrated with a massive new box set and four-part podcast series. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. Dozens of women have accused disgraced movie producer Harvey Weinstein of sexual assault and misconduct. With a criminal trial looming, the New York Times reports that Weinstein has reached a tentative $25 million settlement with a few dozen of his accusers over civil suits that they filed. Attorney Deborah Katz has a lot of experience with sexual misconduct cases in the entertainment industry. She currently represents former Weinstein Company executive Irwin Ryder, who was on the record as having confronted Weinstein about his behavior. We got her on the line from New York City to help put the Weinstein settlement into perspective. She explained how none of the $25 million settlement is coming out of Weinstein's personal pocketbook, thanks to insurance.
Companies can purchase directors and officers insurance that protects companies from liability when directors and officers engage in misconduct. There's also what's called ELI insurance, or employment law insurance, which protects companies from claims brought against the companies for discrimination, sexual harassment, and the like by employees. And those are separate categories of insurance. So it's a prudent business decision for companies to have insurance in place, because many claims can be brought, whether they're meritorious or not. And it's fairly common that companies, especially large companies, that purchase these kind of policies.
My basic understanding of insurance is, say, if I purposely burn down my own home, my insurance company won't cover that if it can be proven that I intentionally burned down my own home.
That's correct. And in cases of intentional misconduct, insurance companies can reserve coverage and essentially say, we're not going to take out coverage because you've engaged in an illegal act and we will not pay insurance. And you see a lot of litigation that goes on between companies and carriers where carriers say, we're not going to cover this. If you are engaging in corporate fraud and bilk your company, that's not going to be an act that is going to be covered under these kind of policies. So carriers look at these kind of claims one by one and make a decision about what they will cover and what they won't cover.
This agreement also means that Weinstein can settle the issue with dozens of accusers without any admission of guilt. But is it ever possible for a payout to include an admission of some sort? Or is that just how it works when you reach a settlement that avoids more time in court or involving a jury, say?
Typically the case that companies insist on non-admission of liability in connection with settlement of these kind of claims. And perhaps, as this was being negotiated with a criminal trial confronting Weinstein in the next month, that was something that was negotiated. I wasn't privy to those negotiations.
Well, the attorney representing the accusers says this was the best deal that they could get. But given all the bad press around Weinstein and the popularity of Me Too, the fact that this was essentially an open secret in Hollywood, his behavior, why do you think they couldn't get more?
The Weinstein Company went into bankruptcy. It had no assets, so that was not a pocket that money could be drawn from. I understand that Harvey Weinstein was threatening to go into personal bankruptcy with no money for the victims through that. And the more time that went on, the less money was available through this insurance policy. So as I understand it, the lawyers who were intimately involved with this felt that this was the best deal that they could negotiate, because there was less money available the more time went on. And through bankruptcy, the Weinstein Company, the individuals who were insured, et cetera, were having their legal fees paid as well. So you see that a significant portion of the money that's going to be paid is to pay for legal fees incurred by these entities, because the carriers also have to pay for legal fees incurred in defense of these kind of claims. So it's terrible that the victims of serious abuse and harassment are not getting more. But it sounds like it was a pragmatic decision to make sure that people got some money as opposed to no money. And that's, you know, unfortunately often the case. I mean, what dollar do you put to the indignity of being raped by this man? There's not enough money in the world to adequately compensate people for the indignities and the violence that they endured. But the lawyers, in their best judgment, concluded that there wouldn't be more money available over time. There was less.
We're talking with civil rights lawyer Deborah Katz about Harvey Weinstein's $25 million settlement. Was declaring bankruptcy part of the strategy to avoid then a larger payout down the road?
Bankruptcy was declared because there were so many claims brought against the Weinstein Company, and there was nothing but debt. There weren't assets, and it was the way that the company was able to keep its doors open and prevent having to answer each of these individual lawsuits that were being brought one by one, but having this in an organized way by the bankruptcy court.
Harvey Weinstein is still facing separate sexual assault charges in New York. That case involves two accusers. How might this settlement potentially affect that case? I mean, could it potentially work in the accuser's favor?
I don't think so. First of all, I should point to that. There's a non-admission of liability. And there's a much higher standard of proof in a criminal trial. So these are going to be very separate issues. But certainly anybody who is in a prospective jury pool who's not living under a rock understands that dozens and dozens of women have come forward with allegations of sexual assault and abuse by Weinstein, and a large settlement was made. Now, the fact of the settlement will likely not be admissible in the criminal trial, but just as we're talking about it, I'm sure others are as well.
That's civil rights attorney Deborah Katz joining us on the line from Manhattan. Deborah, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Coming up on The Frame, an edgy production of the classic ballet Swan Lake takes flight once again. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. Choreographer Matthew Bourne ruffled a few feathers when he first brought his production of Swan Lake to Los Angeles in 1997. Traditionalists were aghast that he had cast male dancers as the swans, roles that traditionally are performed by ballerinas. The striking interpretation was an international hit, and Bourne's latest production of Swan Lake is currently at the Amundsen Theater in downtown L.A. Bourne recently spoke with The Frame's host, John Horn.
The first date here in L.A. was a gamble, actually. We'd never been abroad before. Gordon Davidson was running the Amundsen at that time. He took a risk in bringing over a ballet to fill one of his subscription slots. I think he... Yeah, with a big house. I think he told his subscription people that if they didn't like it, they could have their money back. But it's still one of the most joyous times, really, is when we came to LA that first time. We were so embraced by the city, it felt. And it felt that way last night again, actually, I must say. The LA audience is the best audience for this show and always has been.
I was talking to a colleague today about Swan Lake, and I said, the actor who plays the... And I like, wait, the dancer. And it was one of those slips that I thought was in some ways the best compliment, because I really, like a lot of people, see this as a story as much as a dance. And I'm wondering, historically, what has the story been of Swan Lake? Where does it start narratively as a piece of ballet? What is the story that has been told, and where do you start with your interpretation of that story?
It's actually not enormously different. There's still a queen. There's no king for some reason. You never know why. The mother and son relationship is the same. She's trying to marry him off to a suitable princess. We follow the story that was originally told quite strongly, but of course we deviate from it with the change of sex of the swans. And that creates a psychological difference in the story. It's not about a love story quite so much. It's more a psychological battle between a good voice and a bad voice in the prince's mind, i.e. the white swan and the black swan. That's the way it became once we changed the sex, because it was easier to reflect that.
I want to ask you about how you work with your company, because it feels like there's almost a divided line in ballet and modern between kind of the lower half of the body and the upper half of the body in terms of gesture. And one of the things that's most beautiful about your choreography is the way that hands are expressive. And in this story, they are imitating swans. They're doing a lot of different things. But when you think about the trunk and the legs, do you feel like there is kind of a historic separation to what's modern and what's ballet and how you like to work with dancers' bodies?
I guess so. That's a fascinating thought. You could probably write a book on that. But the difference is, I find, obviously, I do use a lot of gesture, and hands are very important. I think dance often, a lot of choreography forgets the use of the hands. It's just a general sort of floatiness to the fingers that you get, and it's not particularly expressive in one way or another. And I think there's so much more you can do with that. We talk about it quite a lot, about whether you have the fingers together or separated, or what's the shape you're making with them, how emphatic do you want to be, you know, with it. A gesture becomes the language. So in a way, for me, the language that I'm dealing with is a combination of music, which is like the script, and the movement language that everyone understands, which is gesture and facial expression, becomes a big part of it as well, because we all understand that. Not everyone understands technical dance moves, but they do understand gesture and the use of expression.
The other thing that struck me in the show is that there are two essential ideas of characters watching dance and being affected by the dance that they're seeing. And I'm wondering how much of that is rooted in your own personal experience about watching dance and seeing the world in a different way. Mm. Because what happens to these characters is that what they see on stage, separate from what the audience itself is seeing, starts to change the way they see themselves and their place in the story.
Yeah, very interesting. My own personal response to that is that I found a much easier way to express myself was through movement. I went through a period where speaking wasn't all I do now is speak, of course, but it wasn't my favorite thing. And I took refuge in dance, really. It's intrigued me all through these years of how you can tell a story through movement. Without words, and it can mean many things to many people, and I love that aspect of it, and I've never really tired of that. If I'm asked to do something that's more literal, like I've done musical theatre and stuff, the actual words get on my nerves a little bit, because it's too clear and too sort of obvious, you know.
We're talking with Matthew Bourne, the choreographer of Swan Lake. If I were to line up the 97 production and the current production, I'm sure there are differences. There are some modern touches you add. But in terms of narrative, in terms of story, in terms of things that are gone, things that are emphasized, how would you describe the evolution of the story?
Well, the story has remained more or less the same. And the reason we're still doing it is it's got a classic structure and a classic message. And it really is about a lonely person who wants to be loved or wants to be embraced in some way. And that's the simple story of the piece, in a way. It's about someone who is can't be the person they want to be and the person they are. I found everyone can relate to that in some ways. It's also touches on loss and someone you may have lost, and people have their very, very personal approaches to it. And I think that's the key to the success of it, is the universality of the nature of the center of the story, rather than all the things that are sort of were controversial originally, men dancing with men, male swans, all those things, royal scandal, you know, Diana and Charles and Camilla and all those things you could sort of say were potentially scandalous about it. And things have changed. No, things have changed, but those things haven't changed. The simplicity of the center of the story has not changed.
Would you say that this production is less interested in the whole idea of palace intrigue and whether or not the stranger is going to become king? Because that felt like that was more prominent in earlier productions.
You're right, actually. I lessened all that. I found it was too many red herrings that were not necessary. So I keep it very simple now. It's much more through the prince's eyes. The other stuff that goes on around it is less. We're not leading people down a different garden path, you know, this time. It's become simpler, but I realized that the audience for the show was quite different. The power that it used to have to shock people, where we had walkouts, is just not the case anymore. the relationship between a prince and a male swan, or whatever you way you see the story, or whatever you think is going on in the prince's mind, people don't find that such a shocker these days. And it's become like a Christmas family show back home in the UK. You bring the kids, you know.
I think that is revolutionary. I mean, I think the fact, and I don't watch the show like a lot of people. I was like, I don't care about the male swans. I'm watching the performance. But that what was so out of the ordinary would cause walkouts 20 years ago is now something that people take their families to. Yeah. I was sitting behind an 8-year-old boy last night.
Yeah. And they love it, you know, and it's, I think, but that's why I have asked myself those questions. Why is it still around? If without the shock value, does it still work? You know, and I think it's because it's a very universal, simple message at the center of it.
I'm a sports fan and I follow kind of the evolution of sports, the ability for now, with help, a marathoner to run a sub-2-hour marathon, of a golfer to hit a golf ball 350 yards. And it got me thinking about the dancers and about their athleticism and about what dancers can do today that maybe they couldn't have done 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's hard probably for you to have that perspective because you're with them often. But in terms of what, not just your company, but dancers can accomplish now, yeah, are you able to step back and say that's unbelievable?
They are amazing now. The younger, you know, also there's an interesting thing with dance is they're professional at a very young age. They're fully professional. And you have to respect that. Young people who've trained in that way and they come into your company at maybe 18, 19, 20, and they have to be able to deliver, you know, and they're very disciplined. It's a great life for them. But the interesting thing about this production is because it's 20-something years on, a lot of them were not alive when I made it. So I'm now like this sort of historical figure that walks amongst them, you know. But the thing is, they grew up being inspired by this piece and they're passionate about it. It's their dream to be in it. And you can't buy that kind of dedication from anyone. So they're living the dream. So you've got that added thing as well going on.
Isn't the last scene in Billy Elliot, when Billy Elliot grows up, mm-hmm, isn't he in a Matthew Bourne show?
Yeah, he becomes the swan in Our Swan Lake. He's our fictional company member, I will say, Billy Elliot.
Yeah, but he does okay. Matthew Bourne is the director and choreographer of Swan Lake. Matthew, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming.
You too.
In.
Thank you.
That was John Horn with choreographer Matthew Bourne. Swan Lake is at the Amundsen Theater through January 5th. Coming up on The Frame, a look back at 1999 and how Prince rocketed to superstardom from a quiet lakefront home in suburban Minnesota. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. It's been almost 40 years since the release of Prince's landmark album, 1999. It has now been reissued in a box set that includes a treasure trove of rare recordings. This period of Prince's career is also explored in a 4-part podcast produced by our colleagues at The Currents, an all-music public radio station in Minneapolis that, like KPCC, is part of American Public Media. The podcast is called Prince, The Story of 1999, and it's hosted by The Currents' Andrea Swenson, who got to know Prince personally over the years. For the podcast, she focuses on Prince's many collaborators, including session musicians, producers, and recording engineers. Swenson also penned the liner notes for the 1999 box set.
I got a chance to start listening to the vault tracks, a few months before everyone else, and I just felt so lucky. I would just sit alone in my house like, oh my gosh, I can't believe what I'm hearing, you know. There were just so many moments where you could feel him playing with his voice and playing with his delivery and his messages and developing these other people, these other personas, these other things that he wanted to express.
Ask me why I take so much abuse. Why am I so faithful, honey? Why are you so loose? Why am I the one who never gets to take you home? They don't know the things you do to me when we're alone.
There's the prince that he had introduced to the world, but then there were all of these other people that existed within him, these, you know, Vanity Six, this female voice that he was developing. The Time, which is a more kind of street R&B, funk, very hard-driving, very edgy, very funny voice that he didn't feel like he could express as a solo artist. And then in his own Prince material, I think he was also tapping into, you know, what is it like if I do a power ballad where I'm just absolutely screaming my guts out? And what is it like if I do like a reggae song, which we get to hear in the box set, or a rockabilly song, or, you know, all these other interpretations of what pop music was supposed to be in that era?
So that kind of gets me to my first question, the origin story. So how was Prince, the Story of 1999, born?
It really started with this moment when he opened for the Rolling Stones at the Los Angeles Coliseum.
Look at all the trash.
When he was booed and had garbage thrown at him, as being this really pivotal moment for him, kind of a make or break moment of, am I really going to do this? Am I really going to face these people who do not like me and try to win them over? And as Lisa Coleman told me, he really looked out at that full crowd going as far as the eye could see and thought, these are the people, the white rock fans that I'm going to have to win over if I really want to be a rock star.
And you see those two concerts as pivotal in at this point in Prince's career, when he then turns back and goes into the studio at Lake Riley, his home studio.
Absolutely, because if you think about all of the songs that Prince wrote in that winter following that experience, those shows were in October, he went out on the road. He had to go promote an album. Controversy came out actually just a few weeks after the booing. Mm-hmm. But then in that winter, anytime he had any free moments or breaks from the road, he would just hole up in the studio, and he wrote enough songs to have his own double album and then two full albums by his side projects, The Time and Vanity Six. So it just jump-started this prolific period of creation for him.
Mm-hmm. What is your connection to Prince as a fan and as a journalist who covers music in Minnesota? And I believe you're a native of the area, so you probably grew up hearing Prince's music when he was making it right there.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I've been a journalist for about 15 years, and I specialize in Minnesota music. So I knew I had to be a Prince expert. I had to know my stuff if I was going to write about local music here. But I got a chance to see him perform so many times, and I was really writing a lot about what he was up to in recent years and the new albums that he was making. And then I got a chance to go out to Paisley Park and meet with him. He made it clear that he was reading what I wrote about him. And he would occasionally tweet out links to my concert reviews when I would go out to Paisley Park and write about him. So we had this kind of funny relationship where I knew that he knew that he was reading everything.
I don't think we hear Prince's voice at all in the podcast, and I'm wondering why we don't hear from him other than via his music.
That's a great question. There's a boring answer, which is that when you make a podcast, there's all these rights issues, and
I see.
All the recordings of Prince's voice that are in the public domain are owned by other companies. So, you know, we didn't get an opportunity to incorporate those. I would have loved to include especially his interview with Larry King about the meaning behind 1999.
Tell me the origin of that.
We were sitting around watching a special about 1999.
You know, the story goes that they were on tour and they all checked into a hotel that had HBO and all watched the same documentary about Nostradamus and his predictions that the world was going to end in 1999. And Prince wrote the song that night and showed it to the band the next day. And Prince said that all of his friends were freaking out and saying, oh my gosh, can you believe it? The world's going to end. And because of his faith,
I always knew I'd be cool. I just wanted to write something that gave hope.
Well, throughout the 1999 podcast, we hear the voices of many of Prince's closest collaborators. Let's hear an excerpt. This is recording engineer Peggy McCreary talking about working on a song called How Come You Don't Call Me Anymore. It's one of the bonus tracks included in a deluxe reissue of the 1999 album.
When he would go out, like most musicians would go out and relax, and you could go out and get something to eat or go to the bathroom or something, you kept your eye on him because it could all of a sudden be full-on session. So there were times that he would just go out and play the piano, and I loved that.
So, Andrea, what did you learn from talking to Prince's closest collaborators like Peggy McCreary? It would seem like an engineer like her, you know, was partially responsible for, you know, the outtake material that we're now able to hear.
Absolutely. I loved talking to Peggy. And I actually asked her at one point, you know, I have heard from other people that the sound of 1999 is really the sound of Prince alone in a studio with Peggy McCreary.
Peggy, are you listening?
He so consistently made it a priority to elevate women in his work and to help women get a leg up in the music industry. And it gave so many women opportunities, and so many of his proteges were women. And I think that that's absolutely a theme throughout his career, including in this era.
Andrea Swenson is host of the four-part podcast Prince, The Story of 1999. She also hosts the local show on 89.3 FM, The Current, in Minnesota's Twin Cities. Andrea, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You can find that Prince podcast as well as The Frame through your favorite podcast source. And that's all for today. Remember to keep up with us on Twitter and Facebook. We are at The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.